You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Now, after the most expensive judicial race in American history, liberal Justice Janet Protasiewicz was sworn in earlier this month to Wisconsin's Supreme Court, giving liberals a 4-3 majority and ending 15 years of conservative control. The opening days of the new court have been rocky. The new liberal majority stripped some powers from conservative Chief Justice Annette Ziegler and fired the state director of courts. Ziegler has called those actions, quote, nothing short of a coup, and said she would consider suing. Meanwhile, Republican state lawmakers have said they would consider impeaching Protasiewicz if she doesn't recuse herself from cases addressing abortion and redistricting, citing comments she made on the campaign trail. We're talking about Wisconsin's state Supreme Court, which just this month gained a liberal majority for the first time in a decade and a half. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. What are you hoping to see from this court? Do you think Justice Protasiewicz should recuse herself on cases involving issues she talked about during the campaign, especially redistricting? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. Chad Oldfather is a professor at Marquette University Law School. He specializes in constitutional law and the judicial system. He's writing a book tentatively titled Judges, Judging, and Judgment, The Importance of Judicial Character in a Polarized World. Chad, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Let's start with this idea of recusal based on comments on the campaign trail. Justice Protasiewicz had called Wisconsin's election maps rigged. We're expecting to see redistricting go to the state Supreme Court. Republican lawmakers are saying she should take herself off that case, floating the idea of impeachment if she doesn't. How does this fit into our standards for recusal in Wisconsin?
Well, you know, it's an interesting question. And with all of these issues surrounding the state Supreme Court, there are a lot of moving pieces involved. Mm-hmm. You know, in terms of recusal and how it relates to statements on the campaign trail, things are a bit complex, right? So the basic idea behind judicial recusal, of course, is centered on the notion of impartiality. And that's a phrase that is often kicked around, but not so often precisely defined. Now, the U.S. Supreme Court, in a case in 2002, struck down Minnesota's ethics code's prohibition on judicial candidates there, making statements about issues, their positions on issues that were likely to come up when they were, if they were elected. Saying that really didn't protect the kind of impartiality that's at issue here, that the impartiality that's being guaranteed is really more just of a general open-mindedness, right? That you wouldn't want people as judges or justices who didn't have any views on legal issues. That would actually be a bad thing. So it's no surprise that people are going to have those issues. And that leaves us in this sort of difficult situation where it becomes often a matter of degree, how much of a statement is too much of a statement. So that's one aspect of the problem that's in front of us right now, but it's really hardly the only one.
Then there's these emails came out from earlier this month with this change in control of the court to the liberal majority, members of that majority firing a person in a key position. A lot of bickering in this email. We've got a polarized court and a lot of personal differences on the court. I don't know. I don't think this is how people expect Supreme Court justices to get along with each other. What's going on?
Yeah, this is not how they draw it up, certainly. And, you know, this is a story, I think, that has a bit of a long lead in. You know, the Wisconsin Supreme Court has had a little bit of a contentious history, I think, going back probably at this point, 3 decades. You know, there was a time in the 90s, I don't remember the exact dates, but when then Chief Justice Shirley Abrahamson was running for re-election and was opposed, openly opposed by some of her colleagues on the court. And I think there's always been, and it's, you know, a lot of the time been under the surface, but there's been this sense that, you know, the interpersonal dynamics among the justices haven't always been great. There was, of course, the incident involving, you know, the conflict, the physical conflict between Justices Prosser and Anne Walsh Bradley, you know, at this point, probably 10, 15 years ago, that took place, right? So there's always been a sense that, you know, at least beneath the surface, things were not going so smoothly. That has obviously become much more public lately. And I think it's tied in not only with the history of interpersonal dynamics on the court, but as the state's political culture has become increasingly polarized, that seems to have affected the court, because of course the campaigns that we've all seen unfolding in the last several election cycles for the state Supreme Court look more and more like political campaigns. And you know, that probably has all sorts of ripple effects, from, you know, not only encouraging candidates to make statements as candidates that they might not otherwise make, and probably, you know, discouraging a lot of the people who we might want to have be judges from even considering the prospect, because who wants to put themselves through that?
You mentioned these arguments, these internal procedural arguments going to the public. Here's Chief Justice Annette Ziegler on the conservative Dan O'Donnell show reacting to some of the moves from the new liberal majority.
It's nothing short of a coup, really. I hope that they do come to their senses. I am hoping that they will retract what it is that they've done. I fear that they won't, though, because this does seem to be a situation where I don't know any other reason why they would do this other than to try to maybe get cases that they think deserve preferential treatment to the front of the line.
So conflict over, again, some of the procedural things behind the court, a lot of appointments and things like that. Does it surprise you to hear that out in the public eye like that?
It does. Yeah. I mean, it's not what we traditionally expect from the judiciary. Right. I mean, ideally, and, you know, you mentioned in the introduction, the book that I'm working on, you know, the ideal of the judge or justice that I have in mind is really someone who isn't in the public eye, right? It's, you know, judges are often analogized to sports officials, and the roles are parallel in lots of respects. And one of the things you often hear is nobody goes to the game to watch the officials, right? We want them to do their job and to, in a sense, otherwise be sort of invisible. And that's traditionally how it is, right? The judiciary kind of, you know, deals with matters internally, and we haven't historically seen these things often, at least coming out into the public like this. Now, I will say, I don't think Wisconsin is entirely unique in this. You know, we are in all sorts of ways kind of paralleled by North Carolina, and I think things with their state Supreme Court have, you know, there have been some similar dynamics going on, maybe not quite as dramatic as what we're seeing here. So it's not entirely unprecedented, but it is very rare, to say the least.
Talking to Chad Oldfather, professor at Marquette University Law School, looking at the latest out of Wisconsin State Supreme Court conflict with the new look in the court boiling over into the public. Calls from some Republicans that the newest justice, Janet Protasiewicz, should recuse herself, especially from redistricting cases, based on comments she made during the campaign earlier this year. Let's go to your calls at 800-642-1234. Michael is with us in Appleton. Michael, hi.
Hi, Rob. Thanks so much for taking my call. my main point is just that I think that some of the comments and the calls for recusal on certain cases are sort of just absurd, especially considering, as the guest alluded to earlier, the fact that it's sort of silly to expect that a elected judicial official would not have stances or opinions about legal issues. And even furthermore, considering, and I say this having canvassed for Justice Protasiewicz, that abortion and redistricting have been and continue to be such important issues for so many Wisconsin voters. And yeah.
Michael, thanks a lot for the call. And Chad, that's something like when I interview state Supreme Court candidates before elections, it's always tough because people want to know, how are you going to vote on abortion or redistricting or things like that? Or at least, what are your perspectives on it? And the expectation is they don't talk about those things. I don't know. What do you think of Michael's thoughts on all of this?
Yeah, I mean, it's so this is truly an interesting recusal situation. And it is very much tied up with the fact that we have judicial elections, which raises that dynamic that you just alluded to. Right. So the traditional recusal is in a case involving private parties. And usually when we're talking about campaign funding, it has a different twist to it. And let me talk about it in terms of the case Caperton versus Massey, which is the U.S. Supreme Court case that that established this idea that large campaign donations can establish a constitutional grounds for essentially requiring someone to recuse. And what was going on in that case is you have essentially an individual claimant saying, this most recent justice elected to the West Virginia Supreme Court was elected in large part as a result of the excessive spending of essentially my opponent in this case, right? It was the CEO and owner of the company that he was in litigation against. And that donation, you know, didn't take place openly, right? It wasn't the case that if you were a voter in the state of West Virginia, you could easily see what was going on. The money was run through an organization that, if I'm remembering correctly, was called And for the Sake of the Children, right? Which, so it's this interest group that's set up that that is meant to benefit one candidate and purports, you know, in name at least, to be about protecting kids, which had nothing to do with the particular case involved, right? So there's this sort of beneath the surface aspect to the campaign donation in that case that really isn't present here, because the striking thing here is everybody understands exactly what the comments related to. And, you know, one could say that this, you know, that the legislature here, right, what is the legislature supposed to be other than the voice of the people? And if the people themselves have, in effect, ratified these statements, have said, this is what we want, well, that certainly adds a different twist to the claims that somebody's due process rights are being violated, because ultimately the holder of the due process right here would be the people, you know, in the form of the legislature. So it's a different dynamic. And, you know, I don't know that necessarily resolves the question, but it certainly changes the question from what arises in the traditional recusal situation.
We're talking to Marquette University Law School professor Chad Oldfather about how the state Supreme Court is doing. Some friction there after a switch from conservative to liberal control. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What qualities do you want to see in a judge, especially in the highest court in the state? What are your thoughts on how politics have affected the judicial system? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Marquette University Law School professor Chad Oldfather about how the state Supreme Court is doing at the beginning of the new liberal majority's tenure. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's go back to your calls now. Elise is with us in Ashland. Elise, hi.
Hi, can you hear me?
Loud and clear. What did you want to bring up?
Excellent. Well, I think I read a piece where Professor Oldfather was quoted earlier today, and I it seemed to understand that if the Assembly votes to impeach Justice Protasiewicz and the Senate refuses to hold a trial, then the seat on the court is going to be held effectively vacant for as long as the legislature wants. Given the substance of the situation, that this is a legislature that continually returns to office regardless of whether it gets a majority of the vote or not, how likely is this to happen? And if it does happen, what recourse is there?
Elise, thanks for the call. Chad?
Yeah, I mean, that's so, you know, one so much of this is uncharted territory, right? These are just things that really haven't happened. Impeachment, you know, thankfully has not been something that's happened a lot in Wisconsin. It's not been something that's happened a lot nationwide. And so a lot of the questions are unanswered. But as the caller points out, right, there is this twist in the state constitution insofar as it provides that the assembly has the impeachment power. And if a judicial officer is impeached, that person may not hear cases until they have been acquitted, unless and until they've been acquitted after a trial by the Senate. And of course, the Constitution doesn't speak to when or how quickly that trial has to take place, right? And so what you could see would be something akin to what happened when President Obama nominated Merrick Garland for the U.S. Supreme Court, which was the Senate just didn't act on it. You know, in a situation like that, then the question becomes, is there any one or any entity that can make them act on it? And the answer is often not really. So, you know, a lot of times with respect to impeachment, the ultimate source of discipline is at the ballot box. So you could end up assuming, right, there's the whole political calculus involved in deciding whether to go forward with impeachment at all, because, you know, there may be costs associated with that. But if they do, if people want to play hardball the way a lot of the ball has been played in the state of Wisconsin lately, then that is certainly a possibility that's out there. And a question then would be, I'm sure that Justice Protasiewicz would think through, you know, is, do I have any ability to go to federal court to try to get a federal court to force things to move along here? And, you know, it's not obvious to me that there's a federal claim there. And, you know, just stating it generally, federal courts are pretty reluctant to tell states how to run their business. So, you know, these situations often, you know, end in kind of an ugly fashion, like this one may well end.
Thanks for the call, Elise. Sandra is with us now in Mount Pleasant. Sandra, hi.
Hi. Because for many years, the conservative justices have allowed such lopsided redistricting, not allowing a majority of the people to be heard. The amoeba districts are so unfair that the Republicans stay in power without the majority of the votes. Now, we vote for our justices, and we vote for what they say they want to do. That's what she received a healthy majority of the vote because of what she was saying. That's what the people want.
Sandra, thanks for the call. Chad, that lines up with one possible argument you were laying out earlier, that her statements, as Sandra suggests, could be seen as being vindicated by the voters themselves.
Right. No, I think that's exactly right. And I think, you know, another aspect of the situation that her comment brings out is that, you know, that one thing that's striking is that any given justice on the state Supreme Court has been elected statewide, which is not, of course, true of any member of the legislature or even, you know, a majority of the members of the legislature. Right. They're elected in much smaller geographical areas by a much smaller pool of voters. Right. So in a sense, you have this ability for justices to say, I represent the will of the people in a more direct way than a member of the legislature or even, you know, some subset of the legislature does. Now, that to say that sounds awfully political, and that sounds inconsistent with them having a power that is a judicial power in nature. And I think, you know, ultimately that's right. But it does point up the fact that state Supreme Court justices being elected certainly, you know, has to have something to do with or affect the nature of their power, the power that the court has, and including with respect to things, I think, like election maps, right? It just, you know, federal courts, the U.S. Supreme Court a couple years ago said basically, we cannot, as a matter of federal constitutional law, use our judicial power to intervene in partisan gerrymandering disputes. But for them to have said that, in my view, does not necessarily entail that state courts can't, because of the nature of the state court's power is probably different. And certainly when they've been elected, it seems like there's a compelling case for it being different.
Thanks for that call. Chad, in our last minute and a half or so, there's a perception, I think, that our courts are particularly polarized now, U.S. Supreme Court, state Supreme Court, that it's worse, it's more polarized than in the past. Is there something to that, or are we just kind of having a golden age idea that, oh, things used to be better?
Well, I mean, I think there are two answers to that question. Partly it depends on how far back you want to look. I mean, you know, everyone has always understood to some degree or other that, you know, that politics and law are not completely divorced, and that judges vary from one to the next in terms of how they're likely to vote, and that those differences among them are often correlated with politics. And that's no surprise. I think, you know, it is different now in the sense that, you know, it used to be the case, let's say 30, 40 years ago, that the political parties were not as polarized as they are, right? So that a Republican president would appoint justices to the Supreme Court who might be considered liberal and vice versa. One of the things I do in one of my classes is we look back at the confirmation hearings for Robert Bork, whose nomination, of course, failed in 1987. And one thing that's striking about that is you have, for example, a Democratic senator from Alabama asking questions. You have a pro-choice Republican asking questions, things that now are just unheard of. So I think that political polarization has resulted in more judicial polarization. And so, you know, at least as compared to 30, 40, 50 years ago, things are worse.
Chad, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Happy to do it. Thank you.
That's Chad Oldfather, professor at Marquette University Law School. He talked to us today about the new liberal majority on the Wisconsin Supreme Court and tensions within the court revealed by emails and public statements. You can follow news on that at WPR.org.